Did say
what?
What? What?
You are. I think I might cut this bit out. Ah, yes. There we go.
Show right there.
All right. That was a reference to Jeremy's height for those of you who weren't playing.
Oh, no. Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to Bad Voltage Season 1, the never-ending season, episode 26. We have a fine collection of content for your listening pleasure. What are we going to be talking about, Mr. Langridge?
We're going to be talking about the device called Portal by a company called Arubix and their crowdfunding campaign.
And then I'm going to review the amazing Galaxy Camera 2. What do I think of this astounding revolutionary device? Well, you'll just have to listen to find out.
And then we're going to talk about a competition going on right now by Jono's new employer, the Global Learning X Prize.
We're then going to move on and talk about the interesting and potentially thorny subject of genetics and how genetic information is stored with this website called 23andMe and all the privacy and the family connection implications that are involved right there.
And we have a potential special announcement about the idea of live voltage.
Go on, Jeremy.
Shut up, John.
Sa-sa-sa. Bad voltage.
K-sa-ra-sa-ra.
Not K-sa-ra-sa-ra.
I saw an interesting story recently about this company called Arubix, as in a Rubik's Cube. They released this product called, or they announced this product called the Portal. And it's basically, imagine a smartwatch that's been extended to look like the size of a screen. It basically goes against your arm, right? They launched this crowdfunding campaign to raise money to build this thing. Now, this is a pretty beefy device, right? It's got like it's got a bendable Kevlar reinforced screen exterior. It's got a 6-inch screen or 4-inch screen, which is flexible. It's got, you know, a multi-core CPU, 2 gig of RAM, 64 gigabytes of storage. It's got 2 cameras on it. You know, they're making out that this thing is, you know, like full on Star Trek kind of technology. Anyway, they launched this Indiegogo campaign to raise money for this. I heard about this because I read about it on Android Police, who absolutely slammed this thing. They slammed the company and the campaign and the device, and they said, basically, this is complete science fiction. This thing is not going to exist. You know, if Samsung and LG can't create a bendable screen and with this kind of technology, then who are these people? So anyway, last time I checked, the Indiegogo campaign wasn't doing so good. And then the following day, I noticed that the Indiegogo campaign was down. So I tweeted towards the organization, said, like, what's going on with your Indiegogo campaign? It turns out that what happened is that they received an intellectual property claim, or there was an accusation of a violation of intellectual property was sent to them, and the page was taken down. But the thing that's interesting is that this was a flexible funding campaign on Indiegogo, which basically means that when you spend your $300 or $400, whatever it is, to buy one of these things, they get to keep it even if they don't reach the goal. So there's a couple of interesting things here. One is, this device, is this actually doable? I mean, no. Do we think Android Police were fair in their accusation? Or two, like, what does this mean for crowdfunding? Because we're seeing crowdfunding like apply to so many different areas. People are building all kinds of different products. Some of them are really popular and successful, like the Coolest Cooler, but a lot of them just die in their ass. So what do you guys think about this?
First of all, let's be clear, right? It doesn't look like a smartwatch. It looks like someone's got one of those brilliant new bendable iPhone 6 Pluses and nailed it on a guy's arm.
Aside from whether it's possible, which the answer is it's absolutely not possible today, it's not desirable that I can imagine for anyone. Would you wear that?
Wait a minute, guys. Come on now.
Unless you were in the WWF or WWE, whatever it's called now, and you wanted to clothesline someone
exactly,
with it,
man.
There is absolutely no way this
thing
is...
It looks like one of those things that Roman centurions used to wear. Why would anyone buy this?
Now, it is a ludicrous-looking device, to be fair. I mean, Brian, would you buy one?
Would I buy one? I have no idea if I would buy one or not. But here's the thing. I don't know how they would build this bendable device screen that they've got. They also talked about having, fancy bendable battery packs and just a wide variety of things that I can't imagine how it would be done. But that doesn't mean it can't be done.
In 2024, when it's actually ready, you can decide if you want to buy one or not.
But what is... Okay. To start with, this seems a little pie in the sky. They didn't actually show any functioning prototypes. There's a lot of it that seems pretty pie in the sky. But the actual concept of putting something out there that seems really futuristic, but then us panning it because it seems too futuristic, hurts my heart. It makes my soul die a little bit.
But we're not panning it because it seems futuristic. We're panning it because they're taking real people's real money today.
Exactly.
Okay, no, that's a whole different story.
Arthur C. Clarke, that's fine. That's a good thing to do, and we're all interested in that. What you don't get to do is knock on its real product, trouser all the money, and then go, hey, guess what, guys? Made the fucker up.
Yes.
It doesn't matter.
Back
technology,
up a second.
This is the important point. Technology does not work like that. It does in films, but it doesn't in real life. One know-nothing company who no one's ever heard of does not pop up out of nowhere with 15 new innovations. No. That's not how life works.
That is absolutely how it works. I mean, that's how it works for most of computing history. Most of the major advancements were caused, if not by one person, then by a very small team of people. I mean, look at the NLS demo, things along those lines, and the functionality and the advancements leading up to the NLS demo from Engelbert. There's just so much in our technology history, in our recent technology history, that points to small people in the classical, stereotypical garage creating a truly amazing pieces of the future. That is actually real. That is possible. Now, people taking money for products that, you know, don't even really exist yet and whatnot, that's a whole nother issue, and that's a problem.
Now, hang on a second, right? Now, to Brian's point, the notion of a small company coming out of nowhere and innovating and doing something dramatically new, we've seen that a number of times before in the past. I mean, the Oculus Rift is a great example of something that's happening in that area, right? The thing is that the thing that concerned me was that when you look into the background is that, like, the CEO of this company, Brendan Mayers, he's got some expertise in composite materials, but it was primarily around sports cars. And then their VP, Adam Eastman, I think his name is, you know, he's still studying at Berkeley, right? He's still at university. So I think the thing is that I could understand someone going out there. And the thing about Indiegogo is that the way Indiegogo works is that people don't have to provide a prototype. Like with Kickstarter, you have to provide a prototype before you can run a campaign, which is part of the reason why I think Kickstarter has got a little bit more credibility in terms of crowdfunding because of that requirement, right? And that's one of the reasons why there's a lot of different types of campaigns on Indiegogo. You've got like charitable things, and people often do like very like personal crowdfunding campaigns. But to me, it's the notion of innovating is not different. It's that, from what I can tell, this company is just, they've got no credibility in terms of the people, and they've got no credibility in terms of the product. And what worries me about this is, they basically get to keep the money. Now, what happens, right? So this dude called Christian Stropeman apparently has already conceived a wrist-worn flexible display and provided links to it. I took a look at that, and it didn't look particularly credible in itself, like when you looked at like what this guy considers to be prior art. But if they decide to not do the product, what I'm curious to know is, like, what happens to that money? Like, if I just put $400 down on a product to buy one of these things because I think it looks cool, like, I'm assuming that Indiegogo will refund it, but, like,
why would you assume crowdfunding? I think there's a difference between, if you do a campaign and say, okay, we failed to make our target, or you do a campaign and say, well, it's flexibly funded, so whatever you give us, we get to keep. But there's a difference between failing to make your target and having your campaign pulled by Indiegogo themselves.
Exactly. I'm assuming that it would be outside. I'm assuming that in the terms, I haven't read it, but I'm assuming that in the terms and conditions, one of the rules is that whatever you're building, you have to have the rights to be able to build whatever you're building.
Jono, you'll probably know about this. If you do a flexible funding campaign, say it runs from today until next week, and a guy pays today, does the person running the campaign get that money today, or do they get the money at the close of the campaign?
I believe that they get it today.
Right, so if I go and donate money to an Indiegogo, to a flexibly funded Indiegogo campaign today, running the campaign have my money. It's not kept until the campaign closes before it's handed over.
I believe so, yeah.
Oh,
I believe I believe that don't quote me on this, although the fact that this is a fucking podcast.
If that's the case, it's not a question of
corrected.
Indiegogo refunding them. It's going to need to be Arubix who need to refund them because they've already got the money.
As far as I know, what happens is the money. So if you go and spend $400 on the Arubix thing, that money goes to Indiegogo. They hold on to it, and then when the campaign concludes, that money is then sent to Arubix. Right. And I think the reason for that, I'm assuming that there is, if that's the way it does work, is because then obviously Indiegogo, they can get some interest on the money that goes in there.
Well, yeah,
as well as the 4% or 9% fee that they pull
for. They're basically running arbitrage on that. And it means that if situations like this arise, which they must have thought of when they set Indiegogo up, all they need to do is pull the lever and give all the money back. You don't have to say to people, well, sorry, it's not our problem. We're just a middleman. You have to go and chase Arubix for this.
And to be fair, and as well, I mean, I've worked with Indiegogo twice now, once on the Ubuntu Edge campaign and obviously with the Global Learning XPRIZE campaign that's running now. And Indiegogo are a great company. Like, I got to say, I've got nothing but respect for them. So I don't deny that they will do whatever's in the best interests of their consumers. The thing that I think's interesting here is, what's to stop? I mean, let's assume for a second. I don't think this is a scam, this whole Arubix thing. I think it is. I think they genuinely believe that they can build this thing. But, you know, there's a lot of people out there who have really wild and zany ideas that they can do it. And then when it comes down to the reality of the situation, they can't do it. And it seems like crowdfunding is the perfect forum in which they can get money for this. But I think it feels to me like what we need more of in crowdfunding is some kind of more rigor around expectations of delivery. And maybe that's what Kickstarter do. Because I think the thing that people saw with this campaign was it just looks absolutely mad. Like, I could go out there and say, hey, people, for $100, I'm going to make a hoverboard. I bet you anything that thing would fund in next to no time because everybody wants a hoverboard.
This is why Kickstarters do what they do. It is impossible, a priori, to tell the difference between if I had £500,000, I could build this thing, and I think if I had £500,000, I could build this thing, but actually I'm wrong. Because you can't find that out until you spend the £500,000. The whole point of crowdfunding projects was precisely to get you over the initial hump where you're like, I could build this thing, but I don't have the seed capital. But you can't tell the difference between that and the fact and you believing a thing which is actually impossible, but you don't find that out until you spend all the money.
But that's why
Kickstarter require you to provide a prototype, because it proves that you haven't just made up some lies and written them on a bit of paper. You've actually done enough thought, enough work on it to at least conceptually prove, you know, to at least prove the concept, even if not.
I have given to a couple of crowdfunding campaigns that I thought, man, I don't think they're actually going to ship this final thing that they're talking about. But I wanted to see progress be made towards the ability to do it. And so I contributed to a few different software ones, especially where I thought, okay, well, this at least will help advance things forward. And I guess there's two ways to look at it. For one, for crowdfunding is we crowdfund the future. We try and push small companies and organizations to do crazy stuff like that, to have ridiculous looking wrist wearable bendable phone thingies, and that's awesome. I mean, I don't know if I even want one, but it's cool in future. And let's fund the crap out of it. Let's all give $10 and see how far we can get on it. Maybe the only thing is that we actually do get a better bendable screen that's cheaper to make, but the rest of it was just pie in the sky stupid. None of it was actually going to happen. It's still cool that we tried, and I like that. Well, but I don't know. But promising that you can do a product for a set amount of money using a set of technologies that really haven't been tested and proven to be tried and true and manufacturable, that's a whole nother problem.
Well, I wonder on that note whether Like, when I think a lot of people, I would imagine that most people look at crowdfunding from the perspective of a consumer, right? So as a consumer, you can go through, and it's really fun looking at the technology section on Indiegogo or on Kickstarter, because there's loads of cool stuff that people are doing. But we look at it from the perspective of, I spend my money on the perk, and with that perk, I get certain things. So I'm looking at it from a consumer perspective, and therefore you have expectations of quality and delivery and all that kind of stuff. I wonder what's going to happen here is that people are going to look at these crowdfunding campaigns from the perspective more like a VC, where, you know, 9 out of 10 of those products will fail to ship, or they'll ship late or whatever else. I wonder whether the expectation of crowdfunding is going to be
the same consumer model.
Right, because, you know, if I have, let's say, $400 a year that I'm going to spend on crowdfunding, or $1,000 a year, and my expectation is that only $200 of that is going to net actual products, but my other dollars may go into supporting a product that then results in someone else being successful. That might be, because like with Ubuntu Edge, right? It didn't succeed, but what it demonstrated was a thirst and an interest for Ubuntu phones, right, as an example. So it actually had a useful outcome.
Right, but most people are not going to go into a year saying, I have X amount of dollars to spend on a crowd, you know, funded projects in general. They're going to say, I want this one project or product or whatever it may be that happens to be crowdfunded.
And to be fair, I think the Ubuntu phone's a different case.
The Ubuntu project for the phone was going into the crowdfunding with...
I think so too. And really, look at it, it did show that people wanted something like that, and yet no one has made it. It doesn't exist. Nobody has made it. Ubuntu hasn't made it. Ubuntu's talked about making it, but even the software isn't really there yet.
No, but what it did do, as soon as that crowdfunding campaign went live, CEOs of major networks and manufacturing companies suddenly were interested. As soon as that thing went live and it made like 2 million on the first day. So my point is that crowdfunding does have multiple benefits in this kind of way, but I wonder whether a crowdfunding service that is focused, what sets the expectations around, this is more about an investment at like a VC type thing, like micro VCs,
you're missing basic economics.
Oh, Jono, yes. You're so dumb.
The whole point of venture capital funding is that you expect 9 of your 10 projects or 99 of your 100 projects that you fund to crater, but the 100th one pays you back for the other 99
in space. Right.
If you treat crowdfunding as micro VC, right, then 9 out of 10 of the things that you fund fail and you lose the money. And with the 10th one, you just get the product that you'd have got anyway. You're not getting extra payback for your investment.
But the investment there is so much bigger. So therefore you expect the return. What I'm saying is that, like, speaking personally, if I saw, let's say, 5 different projects available that are really ambitious, and I decided to put $100 into one of them because I think they may succeed. It's essentially gambling, right? What I do, I'd be happy if I lose that $100 because the investment's not significant. Now, I wouldn't do that with $1 million. I wouldn't do that with $500,000.
No, I can see that, but so that's not venture capital. That's right. Basically philanthropy.
No, I'm saying this is a venture capital style thing in terms of your expectations.
But you could look at it. I mean, I think if you wanted to pitch it that way, then you'd pitch it as philanthropy. What you're doing is you are essentially donating money to the technology creation community. You're acting as an angel funder, almost. You know, you're not expecting a return. It's donation,
right? And that's a model that I don't think crowdfunding is serving particularly well right now. Is that crowdfunding is very much about products.
Well, there is some of that. Product. I mean, look at Bounty Source. Bounty Source has kind of some of that going on, where people contribute together and kind of crowdfund specific features for software and the like. So, I mean, there is some of that going. It's just not mainstream. It's just open source specific.
And I think the way the crowdfunding concept, certainly Kickstarter, was originally set up, it was meant to be helping people to fund their way to a relatively small project. The fact that it's turned into a way of buying a product without having to go into a shop to do it is slightly a perversion of its original intent. Not that the Kickstarter people might, because they're sitting on a pile of dollars higher than their house, but it's not what it was originally intended for, really. It was really meant for... artists to say, well, I need $2,000 to keep myself alive while I finish this painting, not for, double fine adventures.
And, you know, if you're going really towards, to build, you know, just funding technologists and funding creators, so, things like Patreon make more sense, where you're just saying, okay, I'll give a couple bucks a month to this guy to build a cool new piece of software or something. Those sort of things make sense.
That's a really good point.
Yeah.
Patreon's a really good example of what Jono, I think, is talking about, actually, and I hadn't thought of it, but I think you're right.
Why don't we open this up to the old Bad Voltage community? Let us know what you think. First of all, what do you think about the portal by Arubix? I mean, there's a thread that I kicked off in the forum that you can community.badvoltage.org where you can go and share your thoughts there. But more widely, what do you think about crowdfunding as a model, both in terms of products that you think you're going to get, or maybe an investment in more ambitious, futuristic type of things? Do you think there's an opportunity for existing crowdfunding services to do that? Maybe a new thing? Go and share your thoughts at community.badvoltage.org.
I picked up, at the recommendation of a photographer friend of mine, a big black Canon DSLR camera with just an assortment of rather hefty lenses. Now that camera, while getting a bit long in the tooth, it's only 10 megapixels and unable to do cool things like video recording, has served me quite nicely over the years. It still is capable of taking pictures of excellent quality, but it's just so damned inconvenient to carry around. The thing practically requires its own backpack and feels like an anvil when hanging from my neck by the strap, all of which meant that I was taking it fewer and fewer places and missing a lot of awesome pictures in the process. It was obvious I needed a pocketable point-and-shoot, which I'd kind of been avoiding up until this point. I opted to go with the Samsung Galaxy Camera 2. Allow me to inundate you with the specs, which I'm pretty sure will adequately explain to you why I made this decision. It is a 16-megapixel camera with a 21x optical zoom, which is roughly the equivalent of a focal range of 23 to 483 millimeters. It can record 1080p video, though what self-respecting cell phone can't do that these days, am I right, guys? It can even do slow-mo recording of videos at 120 frames per second, which is kinda rad. In other words, it's a completely adequate point-and-shoot. Not the best in the entire world, but very good. The thing that makes the Galaxy Camera 2 stand out, though, is that it's basically an Android tablet with a 4.8-inch screen. It's got a nice 1.6 GHz quad-core processor, 2 gigs of RAM, and is running Android 4.3. And Wi-Fi, of course. In other words, it's pretty comparable to the guts of the higher-end Android smartphones without the cell phone part. Which means one thing. Apps from the Google Play Store. I can now take a picture, edit it in the Android version of Photoshop, and then post it to Twitter, Google Plus, or any other social network I like. I can record a video, edit that video, and post it directly to YouTube, all without ever having left the camera itself. Of course, I can do anything else I would do with an Android tablet as well. Make phone calls via Hangouts, do a video chat, though with a video chat, the screen is on the opposite side from the lens, so that can get kind of tricky if you want to actually be in the shot. Oh, and I can use my Nexus 7 tablet as a remote viewfinder for the Galaxy camera, a feature that is quite cool, but I haven't actually figured out a reason to use it yet. The Bad Voltage verdict? The Galaxy Camera 2, a $400 US gizmo, is damned amazing. Damned amazing. Now, ask me questions, duders, because I want to talk about this thing some more.
So I have one major question about this, right?
Ask.
I have a Samsung Galaxy S5 in my pocket right now that has a 16-megapixel lens on it, and it runs Android, and you can install apps.
Yep.
Why on earth would I buy a camera? Like, what's the difference? Like, what's the point?
Image quality.
Why don't you just buy a phone?
So, but by far and large, image quality. The megapixels is one thing. That's kind of the start of it. The other problem is you just simply don't have, your camera isn't as capable of as much if you've got that tiny little lens and that tiny little cell inside that smartphone. It's just not capable as much. Now, if you look at like the pictures of the Galaxy camera, it's a big DSLR with everything that implies, not a DSLR, it's a big point and shoot, meaning when you turn it on, that little that little lens goes and sticks out like it's about to, you know, snipe someone from across the hillside.
Right.
You're capable of...
This is a good example.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, this is a good example of how I don't know anything about cameras, because I thought, it says 16 megapixels, everything's fine. So what you're saying is that there's lots of other stuff.
Right.
That's exactly because you've bitten on the whole marketing thing. Which phone
camera people
want you to do? 16 megapixels.
So what else?
The fact that you can't take good pictures with a phone is essentially a question of physics. Like Brian says, you know, the tiny little lens, there's not a lot you can do with it. If you're going to have a phone which is only 9mm thick, it can't have a very good lens. I mean, exactly. If you go and buy a point and shoot, not one which is basically an Android phone with a lens bolt on the side, but a standard Fuji point and shoot from 10 years ago, it will take better quality pictures than your cell phone does today.
Exactly. Exactly.
Just because it's bigger. Right.
Gotcha.
But that seems like the biggest disappointment to me about this is they basically just took a smartphone and put a very mediocre lens and sensor on it. Right, which to steal a phrase from Stuart over there is a bit pointless frippery, really. This could have been a really awesome device if they would have put a great lens and a great sensor in it, but they didn't.
Yes. No, you're absolutely right. The lens and sensor in it is extraordinarily average. I mean, really, really average. I would probably... So my wife has a little Sony point and shoot that is a very capable little point and shoot. I think it's a 12 megapixel. It's got a nice lens in it, good optical zoom on it. But the reality is hers is probably going to run you about $250, whereas the Galaxy Camera 2 is going to run you about $399. So it's going to be an extra, $150 extra bucks. And the image quality between the two is really comparable. What you're really paying for is the ability to have all the Android functionality built into it, which I find astoundingly handy. They've even gone so far as, I should make a statement. I'm not a big fan of replacing the stock Android apps with, you know, new customized launchers and things like Samsung tends to do. I hate that stuff. But Samsung created a custom camera app for this that is potentially the coolest thing I've ever seen on a camera. It has all the standard things you would expect to see, like an auto shoot mode and a manual mode where you can, you know, adjust, your f-spot and f-stop and everything like you'd expect to be able to do, your ISO settings, everything on a nice camera. But then it's got these kind of auto modes you can put it on. You can be like, okay, I want it to be, I'm out, you know, playing sports, or I'm out, you know, doing a macro shot. Now, a lot of cameras have that. But what this one adds is functionality like, you know what, I'm not sure how to take this picture best. Hey, camera, it might be one of these four or five different settings. Why don't you just take four or five of them in rapid succession using a wide variety of settings, show me the ones, and then I get to choose from the best. It's an oddly compelling feature that works really well. It also has this thing, and the name is terrible. They call it the selfie alarm. And
it's selfie showed up in a real document somewhere.
It's so basically,
does a boxing glove come out of the camera and smack someone in the face when they tried to take a selfie? Because I would buy that product for other people.
Right. Come on, Samsung. But I mean, you basically turn it back to yourself, and you know, because you can't see the screen because the screen's on the opposite side of the lens. So if you're trying to take a picture with yourself included, it'll tell you when your head's in the shot, and you can even say, I want my head to be in this corner or right in the middle. And you just keep moving the camera around, and once it gets into the middle, it alerts you and takes the picture for you. Really cool.
It's doing it with face recognition.
Yeah, exactly. It does it with the face recognition. It just makes it a little bit easier. It's a lot of weird little features like that that are just
some of the
so
new functionality software-wise they're building into cameras are really cool, because the one has it where if you're taking a group shot, it won't actually take the picture until everyone's eyes are open and everyone's smiling.
All right.
That's a pretty cool software feature, really.
This is what technology is for, right?
I have another slightly dumb question, obviously not really a photography kind of person, but to me there's two sides of the spectrum here, right? One side, you've got me with my Samsung Galaxy S5, and that is perfectly sufficient for the kind of pictures that I take because I'm not a photography nerd. And then you've got those massive freaking cameras with like lenses that paparazzi type people have, and people take these just beautiful images, and they obviously know all the details about how to take those pictures. It seems to me that for people like me, the Samsung Galaxy S5, as an example, is more than sufficient in terms of image quality. I took a picture yesterday. There's a subreddit where I think it's called What's This Thing, where you can take a picture of something if you don't know what it is, and you can post it and people try and figure out what it is. So it's like a close-up picture. I was really happy with the image quality. What I don't understand is that the quality of cameras is so good at that basic level, right? Where does this really fit in? Because it... I would imagine that the difference between like the Samsung Galaxy S5 camera and the DSLR camera is not actually that big of a difference. So is this like a market where anybody really needs it? Is what I don't understand.
So the difference is actually fairly huge, but I would say that, you know, you do make a good point. This particular camera is made for people like me, people who don't want to lug around and don't need the extra advanced capabilities of swappable lenses and everything that you'd get with a nice DSLR. But I also want to take nice pictures,
good pictures,
unlike the people walking around with a cell phone. Because the reality is there aren't cell phone cameras that are truly capable in that way. You're especially not going to get things like a nice optical zoom. This thing has a 21x optical zoom, basically meaning it's not digitally enlarging the image, it's actually zooming freaking in on it. Whereas if you go,
and that makes a big difference.
If you go with your the S5, which for all intents and purposes, this basically is an S5 with a nicer camera on it. I mean, really, that's kind of what it is, guts wise. The S5, I don't know, what's the optical zoom on that? Any? Does it have any? Has it a 2-4? I don't know.
Realistically, you can't have much optical zoom because the whole point of an optical zoom is that you get the two bits of the lens
moving
further apart from one another, and the phone's like 9mm thick.
The reality is, if they can accomplish optical zoom with that, that's an engineering marvel. So I'm proud of them for having done that. It's just, it doesn't meet my needs.
It's not an engineering marvel. It's a flat out violation of the laws of physics, right? It doesn't work like
that. But if they do invent that, then they should make an Indiegogo campaign.
Right?
And make a load of money.
You guys,
I have a question.
Go ahead.
There are two different, I suppose, ways they could market this, and two different sets of people they could aim it at. It could be more marketed at people like Jono, who've got a Galaxy S5. You say, well, you know about Android. Here is a way of having a good camera, and you've already bought the idea that you can upload to YouTube and send things to Instagram.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the other side of people is people who have point-and-shoot cameras, like my dad, as an example, where you say to him, okay, you already know about camera, but if you buy this one, look, you can edit the thing on the phone and upload to YouTube. So is it... Do you think it's more aimed towards cell phone users who want better cameras or camera users who want... whizzier features?
For me, I was a camera user who wanted whizzier features and less bulk in my pocket. That's what got me into it. I don't know what most people are going to think, but for me, it was an absolute godsend. I should make two extra statements I forgot to make in the review. The first is battery life was great. It's great battery life. It just works great. I had it out all day taking pictures at the fair. I took hundreds and hundreds of shots and video clips and whatnot, down to about 50% usage by the end of the day. It was phenomenal. The other thing is it comes with a paltry 8 gigs of storage built in. It is an absolute travesty in this day and age that anything would only come with 8 gigs of storage built in.
But anyone who's got a point and shoot camera is going to have half a dozen SD cards anyway.
So, right? This takes a micro SD, but you know, I threw in a 32 gig micro SD, which cost me all of what, $12.50 for that thing. I got it on sale at Amazon. So it's not a big deal, but if you do buy one, buy a micro SD card with it. Otherwise you'll be incredibly sad.
Most of you listening will be aware that our very own John O'Bacon is, what are you actually, like, senior director of community for XPRIZE?
Yeah.
Right. And the XPRIZE people have just launched a thing called the Global Learning XPRIZE, which is about teaching people to learn and read and things, like, with Android or something. This is the point, right? We thought that... an awful lot of people probably have that sort of level of understanding of it. So, Jono, you get 30 seconds or so to give us the full-on sales pitch, and then we want to ask some questions about it.
I really don't want to turn this segment into an ad. But
No. But you get to advertise it here. This is an important thing you're doing, right? So you get 30 seconds, and then...
And just so you feel comfortable, dude, pitch away. You can go full marketing mode for 30 seconds, after which we will probably destroy you. But for 30 seconds, this is yours.
All right, so the basic idea of this is that it's XPRIZE's first open source XPRIZE. And the challenge is, it's a $15 million competition where teams are challenged to create a piece of open source software that runs on a tablet, that runs on Android, that will teach a kid, I think it's ages think it's 3 to 8 or 3 to 7, something like that, how to read, write, and perform arithmetic without the aid of a teacher fully autonomously. So the idea here is that there's 250 million kids in the world who don't have literacy skills. There's 54 million kids in the world who don't even have any access to education whatsoever. So this is not really designed to replace teachers. It's designed to provide an educational solution where little or none exists.
Okay, Mr. Runs Over 30 Seconds. Here's what I take away from that. It sounds like it's a lot like an open source version of like abcmouse.com or something along those lines.
Yeah, similar kind of thing. I mean, what's cool about it is that no one really knows what the solution is going to look like, right? So, people may produce something that is more about storytelling, or some people may produce something that maybe, there's maybe eyeball tracking in terms of how kids react, or something using audio, no one really knows exactly what this is going to look like. And part of the thing that's interesting about it is that the actual prize runs for about 5 years, and there's an 18-month development period and then an 18-month field testing period. And the reason why it's so long is because the belief is that this is such a complex problem to solve that you need that much time to do research and development and to work with scientists and teachers and whatever else.
Okay, so what determines, since we don't know what the final solution is exactly going to look like, what determines when they've reached that goal? Like with like a space-based one, you can kind of set a definitive thing. Yeah. Like you're in space, you get the prize. but with this, how do you know when someone's won the prize?
So the idea is that the technology, so there'll be practical field testing that will take place in Africa and potentially parts of India as well, where kids will be basically monitored. So what will happen is the duration is 18 months. So what will happen is that the technology will be taken out to villages with real kids, and essentially they'll be given these tablets and they'll be monitored to see if they can reach levels of reading, writing, and literacy that are double that of if they had had access to a teacher.
So how many different teams are
just taking
point,
it back a step to explain
involved?
It because I didn't understand it either. Because so there's 6 months to register, and then as many teams as you want can register. There's 18 months where all those teams can do whatever they want. After those 18 months, a third party set of judges picks 5 teams. All five of those teams get $1 million apiece. And then those 5 teams are the one that get field tested. Because I was confused about measurability on this one, too.
Yeah,
but that's
so what
how
happens
it is. So
those
five
teams
get to drive it further.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Those 5 teams. So, you know, already there's a couple of hundred teams have submitted, I think. Or maybe it's 150, something like that, have already submitted interest. So there'll be that 18-month development period. That'll be narrowed down to 5 teams from an independent judging panel. And then they'll be given $1 million each, as well as that they will be invited to take their technology out and field test with practical kits in practical locations. And then at the end of that 18-month period, they'll be able to see like how effective that technology is, and then they'll be able to reiterate on it, like, you know, they'll be able to improve it based upon that feedback as well.
So I understand this correctly, the assumption here is that you're attempting to teach reading to children who can't read at all at the moment, because there's an obvious chicken and egg situation there, right? You give someone a tablet and it's got instructions on it, but they can't read the instructions because they can't read. I mean, if you look at, there's an awful lot of people talking about this going, wow, it's the primer from Neil Stephenson's Diamond Age, and it'd be nice if it would, but that's manifestly a product of technology we're not even close to yet. But presumably there's a whole bunch of work which needs to go to the technology here is not necessarily the hard bit, right? It's working out
exactly
how
that's
to
the thing.
Introduce someone to education when, you know, bringing them up from nothing.
Well, there's actually quite a lot of that at this point. I mean, ABC Mouse is a good example. I mean, it's a proprietary for-profit company, but abcmouse.com advertises fairly widely here in the States. And like my 3-year-old daughter uses it, and I just give her a tablet with abcmouse.com running, and it, you know, it does all the stuff, the reading and arithmetic and writing and like pattern recognition stuff. And you know, when she started using it, she didn't know how to read. And I mean, she's still kind of learning at that point, but she's able to use it fine, and she's getting better and better at her basic reading skills because of that. And so there's a lot of projects out there that already do this. A huge number of projects that do this. It's just that there's not a lot of open source projects that are successfully doing this that aren't commercial and proprietary and charge people money, I think is the big thing. So really,
well, I think that's one of the, I think that's one of the interesting things is that the idea here. So with XPRIZE, one of the things I learned when I went there is that there's this saying that, you know, at the end of the X Prize, that's really the beginning of the technology, because the whole point of X Prize is that it builds technology that solves these major problems in the world. And the idea there is that teams at the end of a prize can then be empowered to set up companies that can compete with each other, and that drives the price of the technology down. Now, this is different because the idea here is that this is a mission and not a market, right? And that's right. The reason why the open source piece is so important. And what's interesting to me is that I believe that there's an opportunity here where with other X Prizes, typically what happens is people go off into their own separate silos and they work on their technology, and then, you know, they present it and then they either win or they don't win. What's interesting to me here is that we could potentially have people coming together in teams, but collaborating around common problems. So there's certain things that every team is going to have issues with. They're going to have issues in terms of power management or in terms of UI design, or maybe they need assets designing for different aspects of the experience. There's an opportunity here for teams to collaborate around these common problems, and then potentially for other people outside of those teams to come in and help them. So then what happens there is that you get what I think would be an optimized way in which people can compete to win a prize. My dream is that at the end of this X Prize, not only is there a winning solution that teaches these kids to read, but there's just 1,000 GitHub repositories filled with open educational code. You know, and then what happens is that code then lives on long beyond the end of the X Prize. And that's where I think the real opportunity is.
So at least in theory, it means that what people are competing on is actually the innovativeness of their approach, rather than how comprehensive the dictionary they've built is. Because that should be the sort of thing where everyone could share that. You know, I mean, if you're one team and you spend a lot of time building a dictionary, why don't you say, well, it's all going to be open source anyway. We'll open source this in exchange for the fact that we can use a bunch of your assets or your text-to-speech technology or something like that.
Yeah, well, that's it. And, you know, as we all know, code dumping never really works out very well. So one of the things that I've been very, very strongly guiding the prize development team on is really encouraging a culture of collaboration. Because if we get to the end of the X Prize and all these teams are separated and they don't work together, we'll effectively have a code dump at the end. Because the top five teams, those five teams will all get the $1 million at the end before the final team's judged. They all have to open source their code. But if only those teams are working on it, then you essentially get five code dumps. And I think that would be pointless. Whereas if we have like people collaborating together around common components, you then have the open source code at the end of it is probably going to depend on a bunch of already open libraries and functionality that these teams have been collaborating around. And that means that it will live on long past the end of the X Prize. And I think there's things like, I think it would be really cool, for example, people like Sam Hewitt, who's an active designer in the open source world. I can imagine Sam, for example, working on a library of icons or a library of, you know, I think like the way Jack has been learning how to read is first of all by learning that, you know, a picture of an apple is the word apple. And then that will ultimately transcend into reading and writing. Like maybe someone like Sam could produce a library of images that all the teams could benefit from. And I think there's lots of different areas like that. That to me is where it's really interesting.
So what you're suggesting is that Sam Hewitt should create some imagery, join all of the teams, and therefore ensure that he gets a slice of the pie no matter who wins. That's a pretty smart campaign you got going there, Jono. Sam, get on that.
That's not exactly what I'm saying.
I assume there's some kind of boring technical rule about how you can't be in more than one team.
Whoa.
I think so, yeah.
Sounds like that's contrary to
I very much like the deviousness of the idea.
The other thing I should mention before we wrap this up as well, and this is advertising, is we're running a crowdfunding campaign as well, because we raised a $15 million for the prize. But then what we'd like to do is raise some more money that we can use towards testing it with more and more kids. So for example, you know, we all know that, you know, with more eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. And the idea is that if we raise some more money, we can use that for testing with more and more kids across the world, as well as building a global community around X-Prize.
That actually raises
a
question. Now, what languages is this focused on? Is this completely language agnostic? Because learning and writing for a variety of different languages is so profoundly different that actually the training system is actually different. It's going to be different if you're learning for say Mandarin versus Swahili. I mean, those are very, very different systems. And so having the same system for both would be an extremely bad idea.
So the way it works with all of these X prizes is that there's a set of prize guidelines that are released when the prize goes live, and then that 6 month period where teams are signing up is actually a period for comment on the guidelines as well, and that means that all of that commentary will be then the guidelines will be adjusted.
So if you're a team, you could go and ask questions like, okay, which sort of countries are we hoping to deploy this in? Because then we know whether we need to do it in Kiswahili or one of the other. I don't know very much about language myself.
Right now the guidelines is that it will be teaching kids. Yeah. It will be teaching kids English.
Go team.
And the reason why English was picked is because, you know, it's seen, obviously English is a very dominant language in the global community, and
it's not German. Well, English, I mean, that's really better. The key here is it's not German.
But there's other things like, you know, the language, the choice of licenses, the Apache public license, and, you know, assets will be licensed under a Creative Commons license as well. So all of those things are up for comment that people can comment on forum.xprize.org. Yeah, so
that's actually pretty cool. I mean, really? I kind of harsh on it a little bit, but it's actually pretty cool.
I'm really interested to see. I was a huge fan of OLPC, which I hesitate to call it a failure, but I don't think they reached their initial goals.
It wasn't a disastrous failure.
Right, but one of the reasons that it failed is because they didn't provide any tech support for the machines or training how to incorporate them into classrooms or into education in general, so people didn't really understand how to use those to their end goal. So I'll be interested to see how this allows teams to innovate around not needing classical traditional education and teachers and structure in classrooms. I think that's going to be one of the bigger innovation points. So it'll be interesting to see how that problem is tackled. And I would hope you learn from the OLPC's mistakes. I think Negroponte actually is with XPRIZE now.
Negroponte used to work at XPRIZE. He's not there anymore, but there's a guy called Matt Keller who was very active at OLPC, and he's the guy who designed the Global Learning XPRIZE.
Okay.
In fact, he's one of, you know, like the certain people you meet when you're working and you're just blown away by how good they are. He is, in my career, one of the most incredible people I've ever worked with. Like, this guy knows this inside out. So having him on board gave me a lot of confidence. Yeah. Cool. We'll see what happens.
Right. So one more ad then, Mr. Bacon. You get one sentence. Where do people go to find out more about this stuff?
Right. So you can go to learning.xprize.org, where you can find out about the prize in general. And then if you want to go and check out the crowdfunding campaign, it's one of these weird Indiegogo short URLs. It's igg.me/@learningxprize. But we'll, I know it rolls
totally
off the tongue,
not
right?
Going to that website.
It's linked from the main page, right?
Yeah, it is, and we'll put the links in the show notes as well. So go and check it out.
This next year, February to be precise, a very important thing will happen. I know what you're thinking. That's Groundhog's Day. And you're right. Groundhog's Day is fairly epic. And no, we're not talking about President's Day either, nor are we talking about your humble servant's very glorious birthday. No, we're talking about Scale, the Southern California Linux Expo. And there's something very special happening at Scale this year that has never happened before in the history of mankind. We're doing a live show. Not just any live show. Bad Voltage is going to be there at Scale, live for the prime slot. What time are we going on, Jono? Is it like 9 o'clock?
We're still confirming the date, the time, but it's going to be sort of 8 or 9 o'clock.
Nice.
It's going on February the 20th.
The which main is the evening's entertainment, yes?
Yeah,
it is
on the
us.
Friday evening
it
at
is
Scale.
Us.
Yeah.
We are doing Bad Voltage Live. We're tentatively calling it Live Voltage because Jono came up with that and none of us could come up with a better name. But it's going to be epic and it's going to be awesome. All four of us, one room, video cameras on us, microphones. There's probably going to be lasers. Am I right, Stuart? There's going to be lasers. We're having lasers,
there
right?
Be lasers now.
Just lasers. There
better
be lasers. One of those I agree to do this is lasers.
And smoke, and preferably 30 microwaves cooking Jimmy Dean fine sausage products. Well, but we're still working on Jimmy Dean.
I can promise you, even if none of the rest of it happens, I can smoke for you. That I can do.
Just sat there smoking. Oh, great. Not in that room, you can't.
Now, how big is the room that we're going to be in, Jono? What's the room we're going to be in there?
I don't know. I mean, it's a pretty big room, right?
A pretty big room.
The idea is that, you know, this will be a thing that we're going to be pimping it on every Bad Voltage episode in the lead up to Scale. And So hopefully there'll be, you know, 300 or 400 people in this, in the audience.
That's going to be awesome.
And it's going to be, you know, as some people who've listened to this will know, Ak and I used to do a show called Lug Radio, and we used to do an event every year called Lug Radio Live. And we used to do a live recording in front of an audience. And it was always just so much fun. Yes. Because, you know, as with every live performance, the energy that you get from the audience feeds back into the performers, if you will. And it just makes it better for everybody involved. So we're going to be there. It's going to be a ton of fun. There's going to be a full audience there. We'll be videoing everything. But what we want to know is what, like, we've got this opportunity to do a cool show. Like, what would you like to see in a live Bad Voltage recording, right? And we've set up a forum thread on community.badvoltage.org where you can go and share your ideas. And we want to do something different. We don't just want to do the same normal show. We want to have different ideas and something that's more visual, something that involves the audience. And of course, Scale is a freaking fantastic event. I mean, it's probably one of the best conferences in the US, if not the world, for Linux. So it's usually a really fun vibe there as well. But the other thing as well is, and we just, you know, we've always said from day one with Bad Voltage, you want to be honest with our audience. And one of the things, we know we're going to be there, we're going to be at Scale. One of the things that we need to figure out is how we're going to pay for it. How we're going to get there. Yeah. Because Langridge lives in England.
I know. Some of it's quite convenient. Jono actually lives quite close to Los Angeles, which it's in Los Angeles, right?
Yes, yeah, in LA. Yeah.
And that's quite convenient. Jono's there. I sadly live a terribly, terribly long way away from Los Angeles, and Jeremy is not exactly on the doorstep either. So, yeah. One of the things we're trying to work out is how we pay for this, and there are a few options, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, one option is that we go and we try and find a sponsor. Who can get us there, which is going to be probably a little bit more complicated because it's the first time we're doing it. And we're still growing as a show. Like, we've got a great community forming, but we're still growing. Second option is that we could potentially do some kind of crowdfunding thing. We could have a campaign. And we're not talking about a lot of money. We're talking like a couple of $1,000s, really, to get everyone together.
I see an Indiegogo flexible funded campaign in the works right here is what I see.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. That could be another option. But, you know, we want to open up to the community as well. Like, do you folks have ideas for how we can raise a bit of capital to get the team there? And this is not going to be, you know, business class tickets or anything like that. This is going to be the cheapest possible way. Like, if there was a shitty boat that went from England to America, then I would
fly in the jump seat if I have to.
I'm now quite worried that someone's just going to nail me into a crate and then yeah. FedEx me to Los Angeles or something.
Right. Well, we'll drill holes in the crate first. Don't worry.
Oh, yeah, wow.
Exactly. We have your best interests in mind here.
Yeah. So,
So if you've got ideas on how we can fund it and what you'd like to see in the show, let us know.
Yeah. I mean, I think we'd all like to, we'd like this to be a regular thing. I think we'd like this to be an annual thing where, because that became a real core part of Lug Radio. And I think there's a good opportunity to do this where it's not only about us getting together to do a show, but it's about getting people together. To hang out with each other and get to know each other in the Bad Voltage community as well. And also, we'd like to have things like t-shirts and merch and stuff like that we can have there as well so people can take.
I love that we're doing this at Scale and not just having some cheesy event completely around just our show, because that's just cheesy, man. Like, I love that we're going to Scale because it's great. We got this kick-ass Linux conference. I mean, how many people go to Scale every year? It's like between 2 and 3,000, right?
Yeah,
it's 2 and 3,000 Linux nerds, our people, our homeboys,
our crew,
piled into one spot. We can just rock out with them all day long, pile into this room of ours, the Live Voltage room, and just basically go balls to the wall all night. And that is just so epically awesome sounding. Yeah. I'm beyond
stoked. And of course,
we'll have
like some big gathering as well afterwards. Like, there'll be a post show party. We'll like hang out in the bar and we'll have a good time. And you know, it's just this is going to be such an important thing for the show, and it's going to be just a great time. And you know what? We'll also be able to get a fucking group photo.
I was just thinking about that. We got to get a lot of people there with cameras so we can get as many pictures as possible, just because this only happens once in a blue moon.
The man makes a point. And then we can put all the photos on the forum and get someone to Photoshop them together into a really good looking group.
All right, so go and get onto the forum at community.badvoltage.org. Get your thoughts into the forum thread that's there. It'll be linked in the show notes. And we'll love to see your feedback.
So recently there was a story based around the genetic data collection company 23andMe about how some data that had come out as a result of one of the tests, led to a, I'm sure, fine couple getting a divorce. So for those of you who aren't familiar with 23andMe, it's a company founded, co-founded at least, by one of the wife of one of the co-founders of Google, Sergey Brin. And they basically send you a kit, you spit in a vial, you send it in, and they give you a fair amount of genetic data. It's all SNP-based data, so it's not a true genetic decoding or anything like that.
Hang I think on, they it's do all what?
SNP, so they take about a million SNPs. You have like 3 billion or whatever it is, SNPs in your DNA. Right. They take a couple that they think are interesting, that they are easy to get into a processable form, and they put it on a website. If you signed up before a certain date, you got health data as well. They no longer do the health data because the FDA has told them not to. So
stupid now you get FDA. Like,
haplographic data, you know, where you're from, some ancestral painting, and a couple other things like your earwax is wet, or you can smell asparagus in your urine, things like that. So the one thing I did find, because obviously we have a little bit of a discussion before the show starts about things, and I would consider two and maybe three of us on the show to be very privacy-minded people, and Brian probably the most so, and myself, and also a little bit Ack, and I would consider, based on his drop cam and some other stories, Jono does not care about privacy.
Doesn't give a crap, yeah.
At all.
And no, I hang on, fucking short guy, right before we go on, right?
According to my 23andMe data, I'm not that short.
So you don't just get to make shit up, okay?
You are by far the least privacy-minded out of the four of us.
I
how about
care
that?
About privacy. I just, I'm just not scared of the government coming in and stealing all of my shit.
So anyways, I thought it was interesting that Brian and I have signed up for 23andMe. Ack had actually never heard of it, and you have not.
I was quite astounded because when we started discussing the fact that we should talk about 23andMe in this segment, I'd never heard of them. Right, it seems to be a very specifically American thing, in that, which is fine, you know, not a problem. I'd never heard of it, so I went away and did a bunch of reading and research and so on. I was astounded to discover that you two have both signed up for this thing. I mean, seriously? We could argue one way or the other about whether it's a good idea to have a camera in your house which just feeds the information of you dancing naked to the government like Jono has. But taking your genetic information, which is by definition the most personal thing about you,
and then just
handing it over
scary
to some dude on a website astounds me.
The thing is, as this gets more popular, I would actually argue... would I do it again is an interesting question that I'm not sure of. The direction the company is taking, I don't know that I would do it again. Because given what they're doing now, they're really trying to crowdsource things in a way that I'm uncomfortable with what they're doing with the data. But I already did do it. The interesting thing is I think I might actually have more protection than you having done it. Because as your relatives, if your relatives happen to do it, once two or three close of your relatives have done it, they pretty much have almost all of your DNA. And you're not subject to their privacy policy, so they don't have to protect you.
Besides, that's
even more terrifying.
That the Queen has a vial labeled Stuart Langridge sitting somewhere in a library. That's just your DNA anyway, dude. So you just need to get over it.
she does, but it doesn't contain my DNA.
Enjoy that mental image.
And to be clear, I'll be honest with you. I think actually the contents of my mailbox is probably a more personal thing. I consider it more of a violation than my genetic code, mainly because there's nothing I can do about my genetic code. But the thing I thought was interesting was there's been a recent scandal, 23andMe, where, as Jeremy says, if they get two people who are related, they can cross-correlate their DNA and see that they're related. And there have been quite a few occasions where people were using the site precisely to find their ancestors, their relatives, and so on, in the hope that you'd go and you'd sign up, someone else would sign up. This sort of thing, I mean, Ancestry.com has existed for years and years and years, but it was all very hopeful. Someone would sign up and say, oh, my great-grandfather was called William Ivory and he lived in this bit of Ireland, and then hope someone else would do the same. But someone like 23andMe doing it with genetic information can actually correlate stuff. And there have been a whole bunch of surprising things where people found out that they had cousins they didn't know about or whatever. The divorce thing that you mentioned, having looked into this, the guy had, there's a guy, and he'd had a kid, given the kid up for adoption, and then later met the woman he's now married to. They'd grown old together. And then the son who'd been given up for adoption went to 23andMe and discovered that this guy was his father. But the guy had never told his wife that he'd had a child and given him up for adoption. And they ended up getting divorced, which that to me doesn't really seem like 23andMe's fault.
No, so my wife used the service as well. Both of us did, and she actually did find one of her cousins that lived down in like the San Diego area or something like that. And it was kind of interesting. And you know, my wife's very big into like genealogy and, you know, studying ancestry and whatnot. And she did not know about this entire side of the family, and that side of the family didn't know about our side of the family. And yet, through the miracles of modern DNA mapping, we were able to find that and kind of mend the two family trees together, and you know, see how it actually all laid out. And it was very, very cool. And so there are a lot of really cool things, but on the privacy subject of this, there's a very distinct difference between putting a camera in your house that's watching you walk around naked and using a service that allows you to get data about yourself that you wouldn't otherwise have. Like if I had the opportunity to use a Star Trek thing where I jab something in my arm and I get all this same data without sending it away to a service, I would absolutely do it. But the reality is, this is future stuff, dude. This is awesome. I'm mapping my friggin' genes and I'm absolutely going to do that come hell or high water. And if I have to send it away to some random website in the Colorado Rockies to do it, I'm damn well doing it. Security concerns be damned, because this is the friggin' future. So it's something very
But you know what? The thing, what's interesting with the privacy thing though, is that, you know, comparing and contrasting it to the drop cam, is that the drop cam as a concept is perfectly fine so long as it doesn't get hacked, right? The issue with the privacy thing is whether someone hacks it. And I believe generally that privacy is going to be reasonably well maintained.
That's not to the sufficient case level.
That's a stretch.
No, hang on. Right? And the difference with this thing though is that it's, you're basically voluntarily injecting your fingerprint, your biological fingerprint into a commons, right? And you're determining that company is going to manage that commons effectively. This to me compares it to, in a very broad sense, with Facebook, right? Is that Facebook, you put all of your data into it, you live it, and you breathe it every single day. And then you're basically assuming they're going to treat that information and treat that with a level of integrity. And that's the determining factor between privacy. I haven't used 23andMe, not because of any privacy issues, just because I don't really give a shit, honestly. And if I do discover family members, like, I probably don't want to know them if they're dickheads. If there was a way of filtering people who are morons out, because I'm related to a number of morons and a number of very cool people, I don't necessarily need to have more of these people in my life.
And I should be clear, I've met Jono's dad, and he is very, very clearly Jono's right. dad.
Yes, absolutely.
It's not much, you know, gray area well, going no, on there. Right?
There are.
I mean, the thing which I thought was interesting about the recent, not quite a scandal, but the recent news reports was that, as I understand it, what 23andMe were going to start doing was, instead of helping you cross-correlate with people you didn't know about if you ask them to, they'd start doing it whether you ask them to or not, and then just telling you about it.
Right.
And a lot of people were like, I don't want to know. Exactly as Jonathan said, I don't feel comfortable with that.
But to be fair, the interesting thing is a very small part of what they do. They don't really even advertise that part of it as a big benefit. They're actually DMs.
Oh, so they do it secretly.
You know, just
well, no, it's just compared to the data that it gives you, that's a very small part.
Just to give you guys a little better thing, I've pulled up 23andMe.com, logged in as myself, and just kind of looking through it. Now, Jono, you were kind of saying that you just don't give a shit. Well, here's some things that provide you with some value here. If you do this, you can test to see whether or not you carry certain things like traits that cause cystic fibrosis or Tay-Sachs. No,
I've already done that though.
I've already had a genetic test. You've had the genetic test done. Your genes are already stored in a database. The government, if you did it through, say, most healthcare providers, your the government has your genes. So now you don't have access to your genes. The government and for-profit commercial entities have access to your genes,
but
you don't.
No.
Hang on a second. To my information.
Hang on a second.
You don't.
I went to I went to the doctor, right? And she did a genetic test on me, and I got this information about my about my health, and it had those conclusions about potential health issues in the future, right? That is useful information to me, and I trust my healthcare professional in providing that information to me, and that will be stored in a reasonable way. I don't trust some random company handing that information and then potentially using that in a way that I don't want it to be used.
Your doctor takes your samples, send those tests away.
Yeah, of course.
All of the entities this sort of testing are for-profit corporations that have deals, for the most part, with the federal government, at least in the United States. Your genetic material is, without any doubt, understood and contained by the federal government. They do that for law enforcement purposes, etc.
I'm sure.
You're just trusting a random different company than we
You're choosing a for-profit corporation instead of ours.
Why would I add another company to that roster?
Honestly,
why would I add another
company
to that roster? What's the point?
If you don't want any of the things that, say, 23andMe or something give you, then there is no point because it's an extra service. But there really is no additional security issue related to it. The government's already got your information. Multiple for-profit corporations are already trading your information. That information is already out there. It's already widespread.
Sure. Yeah. But hang on a second. One final point on that. With those companies that have taken my genetic material and then they give me this report, right? I honestly don't know which companies have done this, right? But that, as far as I'm aware, the agreement is that that information is between me and that company.
That company,
right?
And
the difference here with 23andMe is that that information is going into a commons, and then that provides an opportunity where people can connect. Like, I can't go to my doctor and say, with this genetic information, I want to be able to find everybody who I'm related to, as far as
I'm aware. You can lock that down a fair bit on 23andMe.
That's part of the point.
Yeah, I can't go in there and say, I want to learn everything.
I
want
to
know if Jeremy Garcia is, you know, carrying a cystic fibrosis genes. I can't see that information. It's possible for Jeremy to share that with me if he wants to.
I would not call it a comment.
I can request it, and Jeremy can say, oh, hell no, and we just move on.
But how is it? How did that situation happen then, where the guy was able to find the relatives that resulted in his parents getting divorced?
Hang on, bear with me. The way that happened was the son was aware that he was adopted. He was explicitly looking.
If you go looking for it, you can find it. And you don't know, details of the people until you start requesting from these anonymous people, like, "Hey, I'm looking for it,
Brian." Jeremy,
you can search
for other people.
Well, now,
so you can say,
Brian, Jeremy, can you confirm this understanding, right? If I am looking for people I'm related to, I can go to 23andMe and it gets my genetic code. And then I can tick a box somewhere which says, I'm looking for people I'm related to. Correct. If it finds people I'm related to, it might tell me there is someone you are related to, but not who. And it might tell them there is someone you are related to, but not who. And then there's some kind of approval process, yes?
You both have to have it enabled. Yeah, and then you both have to acknowledge.
And is it enabled by default, or is it disabled by default?
Now, when I signed up, it was disabled by default.
And now, just to be clear, though, even when it's all
the impression
enabled,
I have,
I go in here, and what does it show me? I pulled up my list view of possible DNA relatives. So showing other people who have enabled this is just like I have, and it shows that there is a female who is potentially a second cousin with 3.63% of the shared DNA across 11 segments, showing that they are part of the H1 maternal haplogroup, which is kind of a neat little thing. Now, I know nothing else about this person. This is just a female out there that might be my second cousin, that potentially. Yes.
But is there a way in which
you
can
send an introduction?
Send that
I click that
say,
and I can type
hey,
whatever I want to them and just say, hey, can we chat? Do you want to chat with me? And they can say yes or
but
no.
That,
and
but that's right.
But that means they have that enabled.
They want that.
On their
yeah.
end.
That means she must have that enabled as well. I think what I perceive 23andMe to be is, you know how your bank probably has an online service, but it's quite rubbish. And then there are things like mint.com where you can sign in and upload your bank statements, and then it gives you a really nice, pretty view of it. So the information is all available to you, but they're providing a really good way of presenting it because they're concentrating on presentation. That's what I see 23andMe as being, right? It's like, you can go to your doctor, you can get a genetic test to prove to Erica's family that you're not an orangutan or whatever it is you had to do it for. And then you get kind of a useful bit of paper, which says, here are the details of all of your tests. So it tells you, you know, you're at risk for cystic fibrosis. But it's a very medical thing. 23andMe are doing the same thing that Mint do to reformat your bank statements. They're concentrating on presenting it in a useful public way.
Using the same analogy as when we discussed the drop cam or other services, what happens when 23andMe gets hacked?
No, that's...
Or worse, gets sold. Which was the worry with Dropcam. It's not they get hacked. It's that they get sold to someone who doesn't have to honor the agreement.
And to Jeremy's point, I'm surprised that you guys in particular have signed up.
I totally agree with you.
Well, like I said, once a couple of your relatives have done it, you have effectively signed up.
Once someone else enough other people have done it, you've done it too. Jono, let me ask you this. Same question at you. If it gets hacked, what happens to me? I know the potential problem if a nanny cam gets hacked. I know the potential problem if my mailbox gets hacked. Tell me, what is the, and I can think of problems, but I'm curious what you think the problems are if 23andMe gets hacked and my information gets pulled out.
Well, the thing is, if a drop cam gets hacked, that information is not particularly useful unless somebody has your address. If 23andMe gets hacked, then potentially people who don't want to be connected could get connected, and that could cause all kinds of interpersonal issues in a family. That would be what I would imagine to be the primary risk. Like those people who have that thing disabled, someone hacks it, and then they basically do a SQL query that says, you know, for all intents and purposes, enable that feature, and then find connections, and then a message goes out and says, "Hey, this is your long lost cousin," or something like that, or a child that you didn't realize you had.
They could really do that without 23andMe. I think there's significantly more deeply personal information available,
and the public information useful to a wide variety.
Obviously, I'm talking about within
far
the
more con- actionable and viable than the DNA information on 23andMe for that purpose.
Right.
I agree. But my point is this: is that if your principle is privacy,
I still don't understand why you're signing up for a service. It's not privacy, by the way. It's privacy. And my principle isn't privacy. My principle is being awesome, going into the future, doing cool shit, and trying to be private at the same time. I know we got to wrap this up. I have two things I would like to point out about 23andMe and similar services. Once you get it mapped, the 23andMe has done a very cool thing where they've started doing questionnaires. Fairly anonymous-ish questionnaires. They're tied back to the DNA, but you know, hey, kind of anonymous-y. Where you answer things like, when you eat cilantro, does it taste like soap? And through that, through those processes, they're able to actually determine specifically which genes cause people to not like the taste of cilantro. And that may seem like a silly example, but that's actually been causing things. They've been figuring out discoveries based on, you know, where hair grows on the body, hair colors, things that most modern science hasn't been able to figure out because they haven't had large enough sample pools. So we've actually been able to have more effective mapping of the DNA of our genes because of this. The second thing is, and here's just a personal thing, you know, I've found some family, other people have found some family, that's great, but you can actually map where you come from in a really distinct line. Now, me personally, I know that I have family that is Native American. I know I've got Native American family because I've met those people and I know I'm related to them. Yet when my genes are mapped, I am 100% white Northern European. In fact, mostly British and Irish, which means that British and Irish genes absolutely clobbered and destroyed my Native American genes and made me 100% white. I'm not exactly 100% sure how that happened, but at least in terms of genetic mapping, that occurred. And it's strange that happened. And I bring that up because it's fascinating, because getting that sort of information is absolutely fascinating to figure out who we are as a people and what we do going forward. So I love services like this. I love 23andMe for doing this. I do, like Jeremy, have some concerns with the way they've gone. The fact that a lot of their medical results testing saying things like you're at risk for Tay-Sachs and whatnot, they're not doing anymore because the FDA has gotten involved in that. But just the same, I still think it's pretty awesome and well worth any potential privacy risk.
We should try and get him on the show because it is fascinating. There's so many different layers to this. It'd be good to get someone on for an interview.
This anyway, is one of those things I wanted to see happen so badly. Going back to the other segment where you said sometimes you're willing to throw some money at something because you want it to happen. You want it to be a reality. And I think I did this way back, like in 2007 or something when it was new. This was something I just wanted to happen and to be normal so much that I was willing to forego privacy, which is pretty rare for me. And I couldn't agree with Brian more. It's just really cool stuff.
Yeah, cool. So I'd love to hear what the community think about this. There's so many different things wrapped up in this. There's the privacy angle. There's the big data science aspect as well. Like, what do people think about that? So go and share your thoughts on this at community.badvoltage.org.
Sugarcoat it, gentlemen. This was possibly the finest goddamn podcast ever made by man. This was awesome.
Ever.
That's not sugarcoating it at all, huh?
All those other podcasts, some bullshit right now. They're just nothing but bullshit. This podcast, episode of this podcast, well, not the last episode. The last episode was a little bit balls. It kind of sounded bad. We didn't really have anything fun to talk about, but this one was awesome. And you watched it. I watched it. I saw these guys. You didn't watch it because we don't do video. I don't know why we don't do video, but the other guys don't want to do video.
I don't even start on the video.
On video.
Don't even start.
Looking at me. It's no big deal. The other guys, maybe not so much. It's fine. What I'm saying is, it's over.
No, you it's like over. Looking at you.
We're done talking. You guys, do we have anything else we have to say? I don't think so. I think we said it all.
I have a question. I have a question and a comment based on a comment that Jono made in the intro.
Oh, God. Here we go.
Never-ending season. Why are we calling it season one? Why don't we just call it episode 26?
What if we want to have a second about this, season?
And right? the fact that it's episode 26 and we do a bi-weekly show would mean that the show is just about to turn 1 year old.
Holy crap.
It is a year old.
Look at you, maths genius.
Yeah. I mean, I'm no mathematician. I'm no Fermat, but that is a year, roughly.
But you know what? We probably have actually been doing it for a year.
I think the first show was October.
Is over. because we did two runner-up episodes, like practice episodes. And we must have been doing it around this whole time.
So we've been doing it a year, people.
But what do we want to do about the seasons thing? Part of me wants to keep doing season one we get to like season one, episode 392, just for the lols.
That's the point. I mean, seriously, the reason we did seasons, someone asked this on the forum, and the reason we did seasons on Lug Radio is because we got to the beginning of the summer after the first year, and then we said, okay, right, so we're going to record 2 weeks from now. And basically everyone went, no, I'm on holiday, or no, I can't get time for work or anything. And then we said, hey, here's an idea. Why don't we just have a break for the summer and we'll call that the end of season one? So I think, I can't be sure of this because other people may have been doing it beforehand, but I think we basically invented the idea of seasons in podcasting, but not because there's some kind of destined master plan for the way you're meant to do it. It's just because Matt couldn't get time off.
The same thing on the Linux app. Every 10 episodes or so, we had a season break just so that we could take a week off to do vacations and stuff.
We managed to weather the storm that was summer.
Yeah, it's fine.
Without a problem. We did this.
And it was quite a storm with all of my freaking travel. Guys? You know, so.
I've got an idea. We've got live voltage coming up. What if we make live voltage the season finale?
Yeah.
And then season two starts like 2 weeks later. Plan. It'll be like a whole new plot line and everything.
Do we have to have some massive cliffhanger at the end where someone turns to the camera and goes,
yes,
but now what do you know about your father?
Absolutely, we have to, but that's on us, you know?
So we just keep going? Yeah. I honestly don't give a crap either way. Like, I think we can call it whatever.
I don't think we need them. But
I mean, I think that they're kind of unnecessary, and you know, there's no reason why we can't take a break. Like, if we decide, like, I think over Christmas we'll probably miss a show, right? Because it's Christmas.
Even in between Thanksgiving and New Year. So,
I'm sorry. What holiday are we talking about?
Yeah, exactly. But we can always just.
Yeah.
Oh, that was awkward. that was an unnecessarily long pause for that comment.
I think we're fine.
But yes, so don't know what we're going to do about seasons. I mean, I particularly like the idea of, you know, as an end of season finale, revealing that Jeremy's been a robot all along or something. But I don't think we need him, really, right?
I think my 23andMe results disagree with you, sir.
Ah, there it is. You have actual proof.
I think season one, episode 1000 has a nice ring to it.
I've got a piece of
paper. What do we do, though, about, like, I mean, it's boring kind of things like, you know, they're all called season one right now. Do we just say whatever? We just go to episode...
It's just episode 27.
Yeah. Should we just do that?
They still get called season one on the website and you can't change
Yeah.
that.
Yeah. Well, why don't we do it? Why don't we do the next show? Let's get rid of the season one.
Can we still have some sort of a big cliffhanger at Live Voltage, though? Now I'm really excited about that idea. Okay.
We'd be really bummed out if we didn't do something like that. Yeah, yeah. Definitely.
See how we hash out how the show works right here on the show, listeners? That's how we do it here at Bed Voltage.
This is how we do it. Why don't we, like, stage a mock argument? And we should do it all
That's a great idea. Let's have a mock argument. And we'll, no one will know that it's happening, though. Let's talk about it on every subsequent episode all the way leading up to it, so that way we can hash out the details. But no one will know what's happening, and that'll be great. Yeah. Yeah, it'll freak everyone out.
No one's ever going to know.
Be like, why are Brian and Stuart disagreeing? Yeah. Oh my gosh.
I reckon we want to get everyone to vote on which language Jeremy has to say "and now" in for the live show as well. What was this one? Kiswahili.
Yeah, Swahili. Yep.
He's so literary, that little Garcia man.
This show is over. It's completely done. In fact, you could have stopped the playback like 5 to 10 minutes ago and you would have missed absolutely nothing, ladies and gentlemen. Right. You're welcome. Exactly.
Right.
Wow,
so,
this is decaying quickly.
Yeah, I was going to say, and if you've listened this far, I apologize.
Yeah.
All right. So where should you go to find out more?
Community.badvoltage.org.
That makes sense.
Damn it.
Do it. Do it now. Recording.
Recording
too. God, I love recording.
Me too. So nice.
I love it so much.
Tasty.
Will you let me count
to 10? It's kind of smooth.
You like it when I count to 10?
I want to count to 10.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why don't you count to 10? Let's get crazy.
Uh-oh, mix up. Mix it up.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 6, 9, 7.
Oh yeah.
8.
9.
And 10. All right. One, two, count.
Let's do it.